Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. A recent show we did on the dangers of statins and the entire cholesterol-lowering strategy brings us to the question of which fats people should eat. There's still a lot of confusion left over from the many decades of low-fat fanaticism and the food industry's response. People still believe that eating mostly polyunsaturated vegetable fats and eschewing animal and saturated fats is best. And like everything, the truth is more complicated. For this reason, we thought it best to re-review the nature of the many different fats we can choose from and include guidelines for choosing them. It won't surprise you to discover that natural, minimally processed or unprocessed fats are the best, and that a balance of fats is what we're designed for. Join us now for a discussion about dietary fat. It's always a good idea to start at the very beginning, which is to discuss the makeup of fats. And I will tell you that if you want to read more on any of the stuff that we're talking about, there are three sources that are going to be very important for you. The first is the book Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon, because this is the first book that Sally did, and she did it with Dr. Mary Enig, a lipid researcher who is now deceased. She was elderly, actually, when they wrote this. And the whole fat section is written by Mary Enig. And indeed, if you want to go even deeper, Mary Enig did write a book. Her book isn't easy to read, but it is a very good reference book. It's called Know Your Fats. And it's probably only available in used copies. It may not be easily available. But again, Nourishing Traditions has much of the information you would need. And then if you want to read more, I mean, Nourishing Traditions also has all the research in it, you know, like going back to the Framingham studies and how do we know these things that we're saying? Well, it's all in here, you know, in Nourishing Traditions, also in Know Your Fats. And indeed, The Cholesterol Myths, which is the book we referenced a bit during the statin show, The Cholesterol Myths with an S at the end by Uffe, U-F-F-E, Ravenskov, R-A-V-N-S-K-O-V, M-D and Ph-D, who is a Danish researcher living in Sweden. His book, which was published by Sally Fallon's New Trends Publishing, has all of the research in it, and it goes down the list of the myths that people have about cholesterol in particular and health, and also talks about other forms of fats and what the problems might be with them or the, you know, whatever. But for the benefits, Nourishing Traditions, Know Your Fats, both book Nourishing Traditions and Cholesterol Myths has lots of research. So if you want to look up anything that I mention here, or if you want to read the research, read the abstracts and discussion, that's where you find it. So all fats fall into several different categories, and I will be brief here because this information may not help you, but it's worth having some familiarity with these terms. You've all heard these terms, which is saturated fat, monounsaturated fat, and polyunsaturated fat. But what does that mean? Saturated fat is when all the available carbon bonds are occupied by a hydrogen atom. So they're very stable. This is why they don't go rancid when you leave them on the kitchen table if they're natural saturated fats. And you can cook, you know, high heat with saturated fats. They will be, as I said, solid or semi-solid at room temperature. And your body makes saturated fatty acids from carbohydrates, and they're found in animal fats, and they're in tropical fats, as you may know. Monounsaturated fats are the ones that have one double bond in the form of twin carbon atoms, double bonded to each other, and therefore they lack two hydrogen atoms. So your body also makes monounsaturated fats from saturated fatty acids and uses them in all kinds of ways. They are relatively stable. They don't go rancid easily, and they can be used in cooking, but monounsaturated fatty acids are commonly in food in a form called oleic acid, and that's olive oil. But it's other oils, too. It's some of the nut oils, almonds, pecans, cashews, peanuts, and avocados, vegetable, have monounsaturated. And you would be surprised to know that pork fat is indeed very high in monounsaturated. So this is the one everybody loves and thinks is wonderful. One of the problems is that monounsaturated fat, in my experience of reading about these fats, is more likely to cause weight gain than saturated fats, and we can talk about why as we get further into the show. So polyunsaturated fats, these are the babies, who these are the ones that were promoted when this first cholesterol fear-mongering thing started many, many years ago with the low-fat diets and eschewing fats, but you could have polyunsaturated. This is a real gangbuster thing for the food industry. You started making very dangerous fake fats in the form of margarines, trans fats, which we've discovered cause cancer and all sorts of heart disease and all sorts of mischief. Incidentally, Mary Enig was one of the main people whose research, and her research and her activism, is part of the reason trans fats finally were taken down several pegs, and now everyone knows they're dangerous. Polyunsaturated fats have two or more pairs of double bonds, and therefore they lack four or more hydrogen atoms. They are, because they're liquid, even when they're refrigerated, the unpaired electrons at the double bond makes them highly reactive. So these oils go rancid easily, very easily, and they have to be handled with care. They really should never be heated or used in cooking. Now, there are some exceptions that I'll talk about where you can maybe use them as a coat on something when you're baking slowly or something. But in general, they're very volatile. And because they're volatile and can be damaged easily, they're tricky and their use should be considered. You should use them in a considerate way. That doesn't mean you have to avoid them. It just means, but you know, even a good olive oil, if it's good quality virgin organic olive oil, is going to have some susceptibility to being overheated and burned and damaged. Jeffrey, you had something?
One of the things that fats, as I'm sure you know, is used for is to power the body. It's an energy source. And the reason why bodies make saturated fat rather than polyunsaturated fat is that saturated fats have the highest energy potential.
Yeah, they do.
Polyunsaturated yes. fats have the least energy potential. So from your body's standpoint, from an energy consumption standpoint, saturated fats are a much better fuel.
There's a section in Mary Enig's book, Know Your Fats, where she discusses the fact that she's comparing the amount of energy storage you get from fat versus carbohydrates and points out the fact, and you can see this with animals who are like gorillas, mountain gorillas, who are reliant on lots of vegetable material and carbohydrates to keep going, and they're very large animals, but they're also very kind of, they have a lot of fat on their body. So one of the things that's confusing for people is they think if you eat fat, you're going to have more fat on your body, but in fact, it's the opposite. If you eat good quality saturated fats as your primary fat, you're more likely to stay lean because they pack so much energy into a small, you know, you're not going to be carrying around a lot of fat. It's different, the saturated fat is, anyway. So we'll also get back to that too. Now, indeed, the other things that you can do with fats is break them into short chain fatty acids, which have six carbon atoms. You won't be tested. These are saturated fats. They have antimicrobial properties. So, you know, some of these, including butter, it turns out, and coconut oil, and some of these others, are antimicrobial and antifungal. They don't need to be acted on by the bile salts, but they're generally absorbed for quick energy. So as Jeffrey was just saying, for this reason, they're less likely to cause weight gain than olive oil or commercial vegetable oils. Medium chain fatty acids have 8 to 12 carbon atoms and are found mostly in butter fat and tropical oils. So these are, again, antimicrobial. They're absorbed directly for quick energy, as Jeffrey pointed out, and they contribute to the health of the immune system. Very important point about fats that are saturated. Long-chain fatty acids have 14 to 18 carbon atoms, for the geeky people in the audience, and can be either saturated, monounsaturated, or polyunsaturated. And very long-chain fatty acids have 20 to 24 carbon atoms, and they tend to be highly highly unsaturated with four or five, you know, this just, it gets very complicated. But now some people can make these fatty acids into essential fatty acids in your body, but there are others who can't. For instance, diabetics or people with blood sugar abnormalities cannot turn oleic acid into essential fatty acids. They have to come directly from fish and things like that to get the EFAs. So the animal foods are organ meats, egg yolks, butter, and fish oils. So you know about that. So the important thing here is that the essential fatty acids have to be consumed in your food. They don't. It's rare for people to be able to make them in their bodies automatically, and they're responsible for a whole bunch of really good actions in the body. So that's kind of the very shorthand version of what fats are about and how they're broken up. So you understand that there's mostly saturated, polyunsaturated, and monounsaturated. So one of the reasons for using saturated fats primarily, aside from the energy use that we just talked about, and aside from the fact that they're stable, which is very important, because if you are using oils that are easily damaged by heating or rancidity, which saturated fat is not, then you run into inflammatory problems from the fats you're eating. So fats can be easily damaged when they're polyunsaturated. So saturated fats have a number of reasons why they should be preferred. One reason is that they don't skew a very delicate balance in our bodies between the omega-6 fats, which are the polyunsaturated vegetable oils, and the omega-3s, which are these very delicate polyunsaturated oils that we find in fish and in some cases in other vegetable sources like flax. Again, remember that flax or hemp seed or those sorts of things work but don't work for people with blood sugar abnormalities and don't work for cats. I don't know about dogs. So fish oils are the most direct thing. When you get an imbalance between the omega-6 polyunsaturates and the omega-3s, there starts to be some substantial health problems, including issues with heart and mental capacity and mental illness. There's a number of reasons for using polyunsaturated fats. They're mildly, the polyunsaturated fish oils, for instance, the omega-3s, they are protective in a number of ways. They work very well in cases of psychiatric symptoms. They are mildly immunosuppressant, but if you have somebody with an autoimmune disease or some kind of runaway infection, sometimes that can be, especially in autoimmune, it can be very important to use fish oils in higher doses. So it's very dose dependent, but a modest dose of omega-3 fatty acids with you know, the usual complement of antioxidant vitamins in your diet, including vitamin E, doesn't have to be taken at the same time, to protect those oils which are so easily rancid. They go south so easily. Just the heat of your body will put them at risk. So having the antioxidants in the diet and having not an imbalance between those and the omega-6s, which can also cause problems in the body from them going rancid or becoming damaged. So again, not saying polyunsaturated fats are bad. They're part of our diet. They're in our foods and they're important, and certainly the omega-3s. But if there's an imbalance, you see study after study after study showing how people get into trouble when the omega-3 to 6 balance is skewed toward omega-6. Do you have anything that you want to add to this so far?
I was just going to say that there's a recent review in the journal Lipids, which was devoted to new research on dietary fats. And one of the things they note in the commentary on it is that there's been considerable research about an imbalance in omega-6s because of this push to substitute polyunsaturated fats for saturated fats, finding an association between an imbalance of sixes with allergies. asthma, immunosuppression, decreased fertility, preeclampsia, encephalitis, and cancer.
Yeah, well, it's well known that the omega-6s, the vegetable oils, the highly polyunsaturated oils, as I said, are easily damaged, and they can cause mischief. So that's good that you found that study. That helps to explain that. So, you know, one of the things that happens with this cholesterol-busting stuff, where everybody's trying to get cholesterol to go away. Oh, I should just mention, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, we're discussing dietary fat. And I should explain that this was started by... It was actually...
Are you talking about the dietary guidelines or the cholesterol, the Ansel Keys stuff?
No, I'm talking about when there was
It was under when George McGovern was a senator.
McGovern, thank you.
And they
McGovern.
Put together the dietary thing. And
right.
The guys who are now at Science and the Public Interest were on his staff, and they were avid vegetarians.
Yes, and they really pushed this forward. So they did an experiment, basically, on the public for the last, now it's almost 30 years. 40 years. How soon we forget. And actually what we've seen is this just, that heart disease has exploded. It's become worse, and obesity rates are up. And anyway, it seems not to be working. So there's plenty of research, as I said, in the cholesterol myths and also in Marianne and Sally Fallon's book, Nourishing Traditions. But let's talk about the benefits of cholesterol to begin with here for a minute. It helps to control your blood sugar. It gives you terrific satiety. It increases and protects your brain. I'm trying to read two things simultaneously. Your hormones are made out of cholesterol. Your lung surfactant is made out of cholesterol. Immune function is dependent on cholesterol, and as we mentioned in the last show, when cholesterol is driven down, immune function plummets. And indeed, mental disorders and psychiatric stuff gets worse when people's cholesterol is low. So the reasons that blood lipids go up and down, it might be worth reminding people that under stress, your cholesterol level will go up, partially because you have to make adrenal hormones during stress, and you can't make them without cholesterol. Cholesterol goes to places where repair is needed, where things need to be repaired. It carries antioxidants. If you are eating a high sugar and high starch diet, your cholesterol will go up. And if you avoid fat in your diet, your body will kick up the cholesterol and triglycerides because they're so essential. I need to go to Mary Enig here to continue. Jeffrey, if you have.
Oh, sure. One of the things that is essential is to understand that there is a argument that there is a step between saturated fat, high cholesterol, and heart disease. That's the driving force behind the theory. And it's now been pretty much demonstrated that in both steps, the science, generally accepted science is wrong, so that the association between saturated fat and cholesterol is that LDL, low-density lipoprotein, which is a fat, carries things around in your blood. One of the things it carries is cholesterol. And when it does, that particle is nice and fluffy. And that nice fluffy particle is associated with good cardiovascular outcomes. There's another particle, high density LDL, which is associated with high carbohydrate diet. That is associated with higher risk of cardiovascular disease and events. So, and following on that, that chain between, and in addition, the causative, there's never been a consistent demonstration that there's a relationship between cholesterol and serum cholesterol in your blood and mm-hmm. risk of heart disease.
Well,
and that's the work of Uffe Ravenscough has picked that one apart.
Well, and that's why it's called cholesterol myths, as you go down the list of myths. So some other quick things is that there's never, and this is both Uffe and Mary Enig and various other researchers and skeptics too, cholesterol's never been in any studies shown to increase heart risk for women. It's much more complicated why women get heart disease. It's much more about hormone imbalances and stress and, in fact, dietary mistakes like damaged fats and things like that. But women are very susceptible to heart disease from stress. Older individuals, in fact, the women with highest cholesterol, older adults in general, have in all research shown to live longer unless their blood sugars are high, and that's because of what Jeffrey just said about lipoprotein A. Older people need more cholesterol because of the phospholipids in our brain. They need it for brain function. They play a vital role in the health of our bones. Would you think of that? Isn't that interesting? For calcium to be effectively incorporated into the skeletal structure, at least 50% of dietary fats should be saturated. That's modest. They protect the liver from toxins and alcohol and drugs, even prescription drugs. And they enhance immune system, as I said. They are needed for proper utilization of essential fatty acids. I mentioned that as well. Now, one of the things that gets cholesterol a bad name, one of the myths about cholesterol, is that there's this thing called oxidized cholesterol. You say, oh, well, see, it's not just cholesterol, it's this oxidized cholesterol, and one wonders what that's about. What Uffe says about oxidized cholesterol is not surprising. He says it's a mistake that people are connecting this to cholesterol. It's actually back to the polyunsaturated fatty acids promoting oxidation of cholesterol and other atherosclerosis. So if you eat too many polyunsaturated fats, they can be damaged in the body, and when they're damaged, they create a lot of oxidative stress and problems. What Mary Enig says is that the primary reason for oxidation of cholesterol is from food processing, because they process foods to make them into powders, and like milk powders and egg powders, all these foods that are so highly processed. The cholesterol is damaged from the processing and the heating and the spraying and the powdering and all this stuff. So, and then the other thing, of course, is the fake fats, the trans fats, which are not even real fats, you know, in margarines and things like that. Now we're moving away from that because we know that that's dangerous. But, you know, in small ways, even when you... So we are saying that using powdered protein things that are high in, that have fat, like eggs and things like that, that indeed you are increasing the amount of oxidized cholesterol in those products because of the damage of the cholesterol. Now, in a small way, there's a question about when you're eating eggs, which are fantastic food, because eggs have all this nutrients in the yolks, and the cholesterol that's there has never been shown to raise cholesterol levels in people. It's very protective. Now, part of the reason for that is because eggs have egg whites, and egg whites have albumin, and albumin blocks the absorption of things like iron, and it also balances out some of the... Anyway, it's a very healthy food, but you don't want to throw them in a blender. No, I mean, no, you're laughing, but people do that. They make, you know, whatever. So if you want to whip your eggs, you know, the best way to cook your eggs is soft-boiled, but some of us don't like runny whites. So you can do just a softer yolk if you fry them. But if you want to scramble them, do it gently. Just take a whisk and do just enough to get them to mix together. Don't whip them. And so it's the oxidized cholesterol is mostly from these food processing mistakes, and also from imbalances with these oxidized fats, damaged fats. So to go a little further, damaged fats also are a primary cause of cancer and immune dysfunction. Polyunsaturates, fake trans fats, they are extremely dangerous. So I've already mentioned the low cholesterol and mental dysfunctions, and low omega-3 is also... So the brain on cholesterol. Here's something that, Jeffrey, you might want to discuss. We have enough time for you to start doing that. You can avoid dementia and Alzheimer's by keeping your blood sugars down. So why don't you talk about this paper about how high insulin blocks a certain enzyme?
Well, actually, it's I think that the discussion is in Bruce Fife's book.
No, actually, the paper is not in the book. He doesn't. He talks.
Oh, you just
he talks
about
the concepts, but he doesn't. You don't.
Well,
yeah.
Insulin is the hormone that opens up cells so that glucose, blood sugar, can be absorbed and then used as energy or stored as energy. And to do that, among other things, there is a key enzyme that's used. It's called GLUT4. When blood sugars are high, insulin levels go up in order to respond. And if you have metabolic syndrome or prediabetes or diabetes or any of those categories that they've invented to do things to you, that your insulin levels respond, and if you have high glucose in your brain, insulin levels will be high, and GLUT4 levels will decline, which means that your brain will starve. Your brain lives on sugar, and in fact, if you are a type 1 diabetic, one of the things that you are in danger of is your body producing ketones if you have a blood sugar crash, producing ketones, and that exists in your body to keep your brain going. In the event of so your body has mechanisms to make sure that your brain gets the nutrients, the nutrition that it needs, the calories that it needs to run itself. So it already has a mechanism for low blood sugars, but when blood sugars are high and run high, what happens is the brain gets starved because
hypoglycemic. It becomes hypoglycemic because it's blunted. It isn't getting into the brain.
Yes. Because that enzyme is underproduced because insulin levels are high. There's this hydraulic thing that's going on. So high blood sugars, consistently high blood sugars, not transient high blood sugars that go up and down, but consistently high blood sugars causes consistently high insulin levels, cause consistently low enzyme levels, which makes it difficult for the brain cells to feed themselves. And so this whole cascade of events happens that affects the neurology of the brain and leads to dementias and other neurological problems, including Alzheimer's disease.
In fact, I remember from reading this paper that the Alzheimer the plaques show up because they're actually trying to do something protective, but it's an imbalance. It's another imbalance. So
well, the beta amyloid that forms the plaques is something that ordinarily occurs. But it, like that hydraulic thing with insulin and blood sugars and the enzymes, it goes up and down in response to things normally. But when blood sugars build up and the cells can't do anything with it, the beta amyloid starts to accumulate and then it forms into plaques.
Yeah, the body does things for a reason. We need to stop for a very brief musical break. I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm with Jeff Fawcett. Dr. Fawcett and I are talking about dietary fats. We're trying to. It's a very complicated topic, so I'm sorry that it seems complicated. It is complicated. So we're going to take a brief musical break, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion about dietary fats. So stay with us, please. Welcome back. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this show and almost 700 other shows, free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. yourownhealthandfitness.org. So we'll continue now our discussion, Lena Berman, Jeff Fawcett, on dietary fats. So to continue on in that what you're talking about is the danger, and this is an important point to make. There is a danger in having high insulin levels. Insulin is a hormone, and it's there to rebalance and to help with the utilization of sugar. But it's like the kid who cried wolf. If you have too much sugar all the time, and the insulin's high all the time, insulin is toxic to the heart and to various other tissues. It also skews your sex hormones. And if it does that, then, now I've lost my what happens is that you don't want insulin to stay up that high, because then your tissues become blunted. It becomes, your body won't respond to the insulin signal. Your body will just continue to, the insulin will continue to come up, and you will eventually develop a very serious metabolic disruption. Your blood sugars will stay high. Your sex hormones will get skewed. So one of the reasons for eating good quality, undamaged, and favoring saturated fats, but including others, is so that you have satiety and your blood sugars stay down, because you're not tempted to eat things that are sweet and starchy.
What I was going to say is that insulin is not just a regulator of glucose. It does a number of other things. Because it's part of the nutrition cycle, it stimulates, for instance, use of protein, conversion of protein, breakdown of protein, and its building of muscle. So there are a wide variety of things that insulin does, which we're just starting to explore what it does. So high insulin levels can be toxic, and as Lena mentioned, it has been known for some time that insulin can be cardiotoxic, that it is in particular hard on the heart.
So, you know, one of the things that should follow here, Jeffrey, is a discussion about how we make energy in the body in a healthy way, because the body prefers to use fat as a fuel, even though in the early stages of any effort, like studying hard all night, using your brain, using a lot of sugar, or a burst of energy, you're moving, you're carrying boxes, even having sexual relationships, you know, having good stress, even exercise, you mobilize in the early stage of an adaptive stress response. You're going to have a mobilization of sugar used as a kind of kindling to get your energy production going. But for it to be sustained, have your energy sustained, it likes Your body prefers to use fat. That's why when you take a run or you do something where you can still breathe, aerobic exercise, you're burning fat as a fuel. But the more fat is available and the more fit you are and the more your body's kind of trained to use fat as a fuel, the more it will use fat as a fuel instead of sugar. It's not that you don't eat any carbohydrates. Vegetables and fruits have carbohydrates in them. And the amount that you consume is going to be dependent on what your blood sugars are like. People vary a lot. If your blood sugars are over 100, you probably have to really be careful with fruit and certainly not eat starches like grains and potatoes and noodles and all those things. So you're going to have to depend on good quality proteins and good fats that give you good satiety in vegetables, you know, for carbohydrates. If you're really healthy, you can tolerate a little more. But having an imbalance in your energy production is part of what causes a whole cascade of other problems, like Jeffrey is alluding to, even having heart disease connected to insulin levels being too high and having very, very messed up hormone levels because your hormones, your sex hormones, are contested by cortisol, which goes up in the presence of too much insulin. So if you could talk a little bit about energy production and healthy energy production, that would be helpful for people, I think.
Well, I think the clue for me was, when I first started studying this, that what does your body actually turn most of the carbohydrate, the sugar that you consume, what does it do with it? Does it burn it all at once? No. What it does is it turns it into fat. It turns it into fat, and it stores it. Now, it can turn some of it, but a small amount of it, proportionately, into glycogen, which gets stored in your liver, and some of it gets stored in muscle, skeletal muscle, so that it can be converted quickly into sugar in the event of an emergency. But most of what carbohydrates get turned into is body fat. And the cells, and the mitochondria in the cells, have processes for turning all of that, either glucose or fatty acids, into ATP, which is little power packs that actually fuel the cells and give you energy. The one of the things to notice about, for instance, burning energy, when you're burning energy, if you're doing aerobic exercise, depending on your level of fitness, you will start breathing deeply, not gasping for breath. You will start breathing deeply sooner or later in your exercise. The sooner you start breathing deeply, that means your body's asking for a lot of oxygen, and it's using that oxygen to burn fat. So the people who are in good cardiovascular shape burn fat pretty easily and pretty readily.
So now we have an idea of how the energy metabolism of the body works, how the brain requires sugar. One thing also to mention about ketones is that there is a condition in diabetics called ketone acidosis, which is not the same as producing ketones from eating a very low carbohydrate diet. I mean, a ketogenic diet is not going to produce the same kind of condition in diabetics as acidosis. It sounds like a song. So the ketone business is how the brain is protected by the conversion in the liver to making these ketones so that the brain can survive without sugar and can also you're creating sugar out of foods that aren't usually sources.
And those are made from fats.
Yeah, fats and stuff. So you have a sense now of how that works. And we made reference to the Bruce Fife's book about protecting your brain from Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases by eating a ketogenic diet, and this issue of a blood sugar, you know, knowing how much carbohydrate you can eat based on what your blood sugars are. It's pretty simple. So his book is worth looking at. He is stressing coconut oil, and my experience is that coconut oil is good, and it's good for a variety of reasons, but not everybody does well on coconut oil. Everybody's different. So one other oil to consider is butter, and butter is quite remarkable. So I'd like to go over a little bit what's actually in butter, and people feel guilty if they eat butter. The important thing to remember about butter is it really should be, it's best if it's from grass-fed cows, and also if it's unpasteurized and organic and all of that. But there's just organic butter is still going to be better than a lot of other things out there to eat. Just a reminder, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I are talking about dietary fats and butter. So what it is a remarkable source of, it helps you absorb fat-soluble vitamins. All fats do that. But there are some other things about butter that are particularly amazing. There's something called the Walson factor, which is the anti-stiffness factor, and this has to do with protecting humans and animals from calcification of the joints, so degenerative arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis. It also protects against hardening of the arteries, cataracts, and calcification of the pineal gland. So it's quite remarkable, even, you know, as a treatment protocol. And it's only in present, it's only, as I said, in raw butter, cream, and whole milk. So again, you don't want to drink skim milk or 2% or 1%. You want whole fat milk because the butter fat is remarkable for protecting the body in so many situations. There's another thing about butter fat is it has both short chain and medium chain fatty acids. And as we said before, these fatty acids have antimicrobial, anti-tumor, and immune system supporting properties. And 4-carbon butyric acid. And it's unique to butter. It's something that has antifungal properties as well as anti-tumor properties. Believe it or not, there's omega-6 and 3 essential fatty acids. So your EFAs are also in butter, but small amounts. So it wouldn't be your main supply of that. And it has a substance called conjugated linoleic acid. And this, again, is from pasture-fed cows that are eating grass. And it's an extremely strong anti-cancer material. It also encourages the buildup of muscle and prevents weight gain. And it doesn't get produced. It isn't in butter when cows are fed hay or processed feed. There are vitamin companies selling conjugated linoleic acid in capsules, but if you indulge in some butter from grass-fed cows, you'll have it. Lecithin. There's lecithin in butter. And as you know, that assists in the proper assimilation and metabolization of cholesterol and other fat constituents. And it also has a type of lipid, glycopharyngeal lipids. I think I did that right. This type of fat protects against gastrointestinal infections. Would you believe this? Especially in the very young and the elderly. And this is the reason why children who drink skim milk have diarrhea at rates of 3 to 5 times from children who drink whole milk. So to think that milk could be protective. Now, not everybody tolerates milk. Some people can't do it. You can buy ghee, which is butter oil, which is the fat without the milk protein, the milk fat, the butter fat in it, which is going to decrease, you're not going to get all the same benefits from it as you would from real butter. So it's going to vary. Some people feel that if you eat only raw versions of butter fat and dairy products, that you're protected somewhat from the allergic conditions. But some people are really viciously allergic to dairy of any sort. So you have to choose your own way of going. So there are some surprising other sources of fat that people tend not to think about anymore because of what's happened with this push for low-fat diets and polyunsaturated fats. and that is lard, for instance, pork lard, which is has a constituent that is somewhat similar to olive oil, not entirely. It's 40% saturated, 48% monounsaturated. So that's going to have small amounts of antimicrobial palmitoleic acid. So it's very, very slightly polyunsaturated. So you can't get away from polyunsaturated fats. They're in everything. It's remarkable. It used to always be used for cooking with, baking and things like that. And it may also have lauric acid in it if the pigs have eaten coconuts. That's not likely around here. It's very stable. It's very good for cooking. Probably offends a lot of vegetarians, but there you go. And then duck and goose fat are very good. Chicken fat is okay, but duck and goose fat is even better. And you can get beef and mutton tallows, those things. It's you have to sometimes make these yourself. You can sometimes find a source for the fat, and then you can render it. And after you're done rendering it, you end up with these crunchy little wonderful... What would you describe them as?
Pork rinds.
Well, it's like, it isn't, though. It isn't
pork
rinds.
It isn't pork rinds.
It's just crispy. It's like, the fat's been sort of cooked out of it, and you have these crispy, wonderful things that are kind of freebies since they don't do anything to your blood sugar or your other fat ratio balance. Obviously, good quality olive oil, as I said, you still want to be careful about how you treat it because it still can go rancid over time. It's much more stable than other things. There's now, you can find macadamia nut oil. In general, I tell people to try to get organic oils. Part of the reason for this is because some of the seed oils and nut oils, it depends on where these are coming from. Some places, some companies are testing for impurities, including pesticides and stuff. The question is where these nuts and seeds are coming from, and if they're from the U.S., likely they won't have this happen, but nuts and seeds that come from other countries are often gassed for insecticides and, insects and stuff. Peanut oil, sesame oil can be used. They're slightly more stable than regular polyunsaturated fats. You just want to be considerate because these are very high in omega-6 fats. Sesame oil, interestingly, is used a lot in like Ayurveda and other healing traditions. So for some people, it's a really good fat, and it contains a kind of unique group of antioxidants that are not destroyed by heat, but it's high in omega-6. So you want to, maybe your salad, There's concerns about canola oil. It's complicated. I don't have a dog in this fight. It was created from rapeseed, which isn't very good for human consumption, but I don't, I don't produce oils. I don't have any associations with any of these companies, and I haven't looked at all the research, but there has been concern with rapeseed because it contains very, very, very long chain fatty acids, something called uritic acid, which under some circumstances is associated with fibrotic heart lesions. That sounds like a reach, but it apparently has shown up. Canola oil was bred not to contain this or very little of it, but the problem with canola oil is that it's very, very, it gets rancid really easily, and it also can get moldy really quickly. Although it's supposed to have omega-3 fats in it during the deodorizing process, why they would do that, I don't know. It can ruin that, get rid of it. Flaxseed oil, hemp seed oil, they do have a type of omega-3. They have, this oleic acid, but they're also high in omega-6s. They're very, very fragile. Again, you never want to put flaxseed oil or flax seeds or hemp seeds in anything hot. It always should stay cold. You should keep them in the freezer, maybe, or refrigerator when you're not using them. Flaxseed is a good... it's a good fiber supplement if you grind it up and put it in something, like a drink or something. But if you have any blood sugar abnormalities at all, if there's anything in your history, if your family history or something where there's a problem, or if you're a cat, you're not going to be able to convert these into the long chain omega 3 acids, not the very, very long chain dangerous, but the long chain omega 3s, which are in fish. So fish is always a more direct. For people who are vegetarians, there is a product made from kelp, although we have to wonder how much radiation is in the ocean these days. That's a good source. So again, the tropical oils are the ones that tend to be really helpful and stable. There's the coconut oil, which everybody's jumping on the truck for coconut oil. As I said, some people do well with coconut oil. Some people do not, oddly enough. Too bad, because it does have the lauric acid. It does have these nice things in it. But other tropical fats that you probably know about is that now palm oil is available all over the place, and you've got two forms of it. One form is processed, so it's white, and it's refined. And in general, you don't want to eat any oil that's refined. You want everything to be unrefined and cold-pressed and all that. But with palm oil, when you refine it, what you're doing is basically getting rid of the red part of the coconut, and that's where the sort of vitamin E-like substances are. But when you remove them, the oil is much more stable for cooking, so you can even deep fat fry in palm oil if you want. The red palm oil, not to be confused with palm kernel oil, which is also high in lauric acid, but very hard to find, and I don't even have a source for it organically. It's usually used in African cooking. But the red palm is available, and it's a little less stable in high heat cooking, but it has a sweet and unique, almost carrot-like flavor. It does stain your clothes if you're slopping it around too much. Probably not good as a lubricant. Excuse me for saying that. So, but it's but it has a lot of vitamin E in it, and it can be used with a less hot cooking temperature. If anyone does find out about a source of organic palm kernel oil in an organic form, I'd love to hear about it. You know, you can always email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. So what does that mean? You know, you get really, you know, we talked about broths and we've talked about cholesterol and we've done all this. So what do you do? Well, one of the problems is that because people's bodies are so unique and different, it's going to really depend on who you are and what you need to feel good, and that takes some experimentation. What you know now is that it's worthwhile knowing your blood sugar reading, fasting, because then you can make some intelligent decisions about how much carbohydrate to eat. And you can also, to be honest, you can take your clothes off and stand in front of a mirror and get a sense of how many carbohydrates you can eat. But it is the case that if you eat closer to a high-fat diet, you're less likely to put on weight, and obviously it helps if you exercise as well, because then you're mobilizing that good energy cycle too. And then, you know, how do you introduce the carbohydrates? Some people do really well with very small amounts of extremely unrefined grains of various sorts. Some people can't go near them for anything, so you have to decide who you are and experiment. My own preference has always been for the sort of paleo-style diet. And that may not work for some people who maybe do better with some carbohydrates and can follow a modified vegetarian diet where they have high fat, you know, good quality dairy products and ethically raised eggs, eggs being a wonderful food. So in these last few moments, if you have more to add, what are your favorite ways to use fat and cook? You've got your own. You're a great butter fan.
Oh, I love butter.
Yeah.
For a while, I should go back and start doing this again. I was rendering what's called fatback, which is
pork.
Which is pork. Not as hard as you would think. Rendering is just putting cubing up fatback and heating it over a low heat and letting it cook down over 20 minutes to a couple hours.
Several hours.
And it makes this really nice stuff. And the trick is that commercially it is impossible to find organic lard. Or lard that is, I tell a lie. There are some very small pork husbanders who sell lard that's from their pig, their hogs. And the hogs are raised in environmentally friendly places so that they can be happy pigs. But you can do it yourself if you can find some place that sells organic fatback.
Or even in some cases natural. What we've discovered is that some places, it depends on the size of the operation. You can interview the supplier that's selling the pork and find out about how they treat the animals and whether or not they're GMO feed. So that's very important. But one of the ways you can tell is that when animals are fed GMO foods, they're very unhealthy and the meat tastes terrible. So part of the way you can tell is by the quality of the meat. But it would be a small grower instead of a large one, and then you get some of the fat. They sell it pretty inexpensively. That's a good fat. I like ghee. I like palm. So find out what you prefer. Just understand the basic concept of there's no bad fat. There are fats that are easily damaged and can cause mischief in your body. They're not bad. If you have small amounts of them and you treat them properly, they're okay to have. But you want to have make sure you have a source of omega-3s, like fish, if you can, fish oils. And you want to eat a fair amount of the saturated fats, not a terrible, terrible life. You probably want the polys for your salad or something. So that takes us just about to the... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, one last thing to promote saturated fats again is that one of the characteristics of saturated fat-based diet versus diets where it has been eliminated is satiety.
Yep.
You're just going to feel better. And another is taste. One
yeah.
of the things that's happened with food is sugar has been
replaced.
Has replaced fat in food because foods without fat are not palatable.
Yeah, and they're putting fake fat in to give you the mouthfeel of fat. Very dangerous stuff. Fake food, fake fat, damaged fats. Thank you for joining us today. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this show and almost 700 other shows, free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. It's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Being informed not only protects your health and your environment, it protects your freedom.